The English Civil Wars, 1640 to 1660. The creation of the armies in 1642. Now, although there were men in arms in Ireland in 1642, in England and Wales, there was no standing army and almost no troops in place as the king and parliament set about raising armies in the spring and summer of 1642. Both sides might, however, look to recruit men from the existing militia units, the part-time self-defense forces found in all counties of England and Wales. Some of the larger towns also had their own separate militia units, known as trained bands. In theory, all able-bodied males between 16 and 60 were liable to serve and to be mustered several times a year for training. In practice, it was hard to compel attendance, and the numbers serving in each county were pretty small, often under 2,000. Even so, it remained a numerically significant force. For on the eve of the civil wars, it should have totaled around 100,000 men, about 95,000 foot, 5,000 horse. Although some units, such as those of Lancashire and the unusually well-trained and committed London-trained bands, were formidable and had real military potential, many militia forces were amateurs and poor. One officer alleged that training generally comprised a little casual hurrying over their postures before retiring to the nearby inn, first to salute their captain with a brave volley of shot as he entered, and then rapidly join him in alcoholic revelry. In any case, while men were happy to spend a few days a year playing at war and drinking, they often had no stomach for the real thing, and absolutely no inclination in 1642 to volunteer. Moreover, by long tradition, each militia was a self-defense force designed to protect its own county, and many were unwilling to march away in a field army and campaign elsewhere. As war loomed, both sides sought to call out county militias, win them over, and recruit from their ranks. But the response was patchy. Instead, both sides soon launched fresh recruiting drives. Royalists and parliamentary county commissioners were appointed and empowered to raise troops in the counties where they had influence. Richard Gough described one royalist commissioner how it operated. Sir Paul Harris sent out warrants notifying the inhabitants of the Hundred that would be holding an open-air recruiting meeting at Middle Hill in North Shropshire on a set date and requesting all male inhabitants between 16 and 60, whether heads of households, sons, servants, or lodgers, to attend. Gough went along to watch this great show, and there I saw a multitude of men, and upon the highest bank of the hill he noted one of Harris's assistants standing with a paper in his hand, and three or four soldiers, pikes, struck upright in the ground by him, and there he made a proclamation that if any person would serve the king as a soldier in the wars, he should have 14 groats a week for his pay. The offer clearly struck a chord, for Gough estimated that at least 20 men from Middle and the two adjoining villages joined up. With less success, Sir William Breton and some fellow parliamentarian commissioners attempted to recruit in Chester in early August, but they met with rowdy opposition. The city authorities intervened and confiscated their drum. But Breton and his colleagues continued the tumult and were eventually escorted from the city under guard, in part to protect them from the abuse of the citizens. By summer of 1642, both king and parliamentary commander-in-chiefs were also commissioning, as colonels of completely new regiments, individual members of the elite. And they would go out and raise troops. For example, in August of 1642, the king commissioned Lord Paget, one of my relatives. He was made a colonel in the new foot regiment. Paget returned to his native Staffordshire to recruit, contacting neighboring landowners, seeking their support, and in some cases appointing them or their sons captains within his fledgling regiment. These then launched a broader recruitment drive in and around Shropshire, not only drawing upon pools of kinsmen, tenants, servants, and their dependents, but also going around beating the drum and seeking volunteers in the villages and the countryside. Within a month, Paget and his local captains had raised about 1,000 men. The volunteers of summer 1642 probably came forward for a variety of reasons, encompassing the lure of adventure and excitement, the offer of regular pay, and employment in which clothing, food, and shelter would be provided by the employer. Ties to kinship, friendship, tenancy, or service, and a clear and principled commitment to fight for their chosen cause, a conscious and informed decision upon political or religious beliefs. In these ways and from these sources, each side succeeded in raising equivalents of over 20 regiments by the end of the summer. And by October, each probably had 20,000 men at arms divided between a main field army and detached units. Now, it's clear that during the opening phase of the conflict, there were some geographical patterns to allegiance and support. Some areas displayed marked enthusiasm for either the king or parliament and provided large numbers of volunteers. These patterns were unforced. Popular allegiance are often hard to reconstruct and interpret. In a few areas, county allegiance may have been determined by pre-war disputes and the pursuit of practical gain. For example, some miners in the Forest of Dean and parts of Derbyshire probably supported the king in the hope that he, in turn, would help them in their long-running disputes against local grandees. More broadly, in some regions, such as the western counties of Somerset, Wiltshire, and Dorset, as well as the West Midlands in and around Warwickshire, a case has been made for communities splitting along pre-war lines of cleavage, rooted in a concoction of differing religious, economic, social, and cultural outlooks. Within these areas, arable and mixed farming regions of downs and vales, of small parishes, and centered settlements tightly controlled by church and resident squires tended towards a traditional conservative outlook and to royalist allegiance in the Civil War. While pasture, wood pasture, and upland grazing regions, large parishes, dispersed settlements with much weaker elite control tended to be more open, these fluid populations were receptive to new ideas who supported the Parliament when the Civil War broke out. However, these divisions are not so apparent in other parts of England and Wales, and this interpretation does not explain emerging allegiances in many other regions. In some areas, a case can be made for religion as a major element in determining allegiance. These communities, which favored further reform of the state church, such as ports, many towns, cloth-working areas, were more likely to support Parliament, while those which were ecclesiastically conservative and less reform-minded, including fairly isolated communities remote from transport highways, moorlands, and large parts of the Highland Zone of England and Wales, the northern and western regions remote from the controversies in Whitehall and Westminster, were more likely to support the king. It has also been suggested that the popular royalism in Wales and Cornwall in 1642 may have owed something to the historical, cultural, and linguistic distinctiveness of those two non-English parts of the Celtic fringe. The Royal Principality of Wales came out for Charles in the summer of 1642, providing thousands of recruits who served as the backbone of the infantry in his first army. While the Royal Duchy of Cornwall, there was a popular royalist rising in October 1642, perhaps 10,000 strong, which secured that county for the king. It may be that the population in these areas felt their distinctiveness would be threatened by an antagonistic parliament in London, where the press was increasingly condemning them as backward and suspiciously popish in outlook, and that their ways and rights, distinctive Welsh and Cornish particularism, would be better protected by the king. Now, there are several traits that are apparent in the two armies that gathered in the autumn of 1642. First, the senior ranks were dominated by men who had previous military experience. It had been estimated of those present at Edgehill, at least 60 parliamentarian and 30 royalist officers had fought on the continent over the previous decades. Although the Stuart kingdoms had largely remained at peace during the opening decades of the 17th century, untold numbers of English and Welsh, both elite and non-elite, as well as a large number of Scots, and one historian has put that figure at around 25,000 Scots, which is perhaps 10% of that country's adult male population, had seen service abroad during the 30 Years' War, fighting as volunteers or mercenaries. Secondly, there was a conspicuous number of Scottish officers, particularly on the parliamentary side. Thirdly, the two overall commanders, Charles I and the Earl of Essex, had far less experience than those directly under them. Charles I had none, for he had not led troops in person during the French or Spanish Wars in the late 1620s or the Scots Wars in 1639-40, while the Parliamentary Lord General had some experience as a colonel in the Dutch infantry during the 1620s as well as the Scots War. Fourthly, most senior commanders were men of fairly mature years, in middle age in the 17th century context. Indeed, several, particularly on the royalist side, were actually pretty old by 1642. Assessment of royalist and parliamentary armies later in the war confirmed this trend, showing that most officers ranked colonel and above were in their 30s or 40s. Now, next time, we'll look at the equipment and their fighting tactics. Now, the sources for this, the English Civil War, 1640 to 1660 by Warden, the English Civil War, 1642-1651 by Gaunt, Cavaliers versus Roundheads, English Civil War, 1642-1649 by Hibbert, and English Civil Wars, Atlas and Concise History, The Wars of the Three Kingdoms, 1639-51, by Lipscomb. So I hope you enjoyed that, and as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out the CDs, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.